Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
Oh, God, have mercy on our souls.
A minute.
Do you both remember what they told us once in training about the theory of circumnavigating time? They said it might be possible for us to leave the Earth during 1 year. Then when we got back, though we thought it was the same year, it might be the year before or the year after. Remember that?
That was just a theory, Captain.
Oh, no, it's not a theory, because that's what happened to us.
Discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination, and you're invited along. We'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone. And thank you, Robert, for that opening. The music was great. Very good music. Very appropriate.
Deja vu.
Yes. Yeah, really good. So I hope everyone's doing well today. And I'd like to welcome my co-hosts, Robert and Dave. And unfortunately, Bobby's not with us today. He's not feeling well. And hopefully he'll be with us for the next episode. But he wishes everyone well. And as I said, he's not feeling well. So we're hoping he'll be here next time. But
you better, Bobby. We miss you.
Yeah, I do too. I do too.
We do? Oh, yeah, we do. I'm sorry.
Oh, man, you guys are too much. But anyway, I would also like to welcome Lou and Rick. And Sunny's here today. She's not on the phone, but she is here in the chat room. Hi, Sunny. And it's good to have everybody here today. So today, we are talking about Death Ship.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Picture of the spaceship E-89, cruising above the 13th planet of Star System 51, the year 1997. In a little while, supposedly, the ship will be landed and specimens taken, vegetable, mineral, and if any, animal. These will be brought back to overpopulated Earth, where technicians will evaluate them, and if everything is satisfactory, stamp their findings with the word inhabitable and open up yet another planet for colonization. These are the things that are supposed to happen. Picture of the crew of the spaceship E-89. Captain Ross, Lieutenant Mason, Lieutenant Carter. Three men who have just reached a place which is as far from home as they will ever be. Three men who in a matter of minutes will be plunged into the darkest nightmare reaches of the Twilight Zone.
Yes, they will. Yes, they will. Yes, as Rod said, this is Space Cruiser E-89 with Captain Ross, Lieutenant Mason, Lieutenant Carter, and that's their mission. Their mission is to analyze these new worlds, discover if they're suitable for colonization by Earth. And so far, you know, nothing out of the ordinary has happened, but while they're investigating one uninhabited world, Lieutenant Mason, he sees this large, just this metallic glint, I guess, in the landscape. So he thinks it might be a sign of alien life. But of course, Captain Ross, he disagrees. Nevertheless, the cruiser prepares to land next to the object. So after landing, the men are astonished to see that the gleaming comes from the wreck of a ship exactly like their own. So Ross, Captain Ross, he says, you know, just ignore it. You know, he says, be cautious, but, you know, just ignore it. It's no big deal. But they do head over to the wreck to investigate it. And they soon see that it's the same ship as the E-89. So then they make their way inside the craft, and they discover their own lifeless bodies in the wreckage. So Mason and Carter, like, they're in shock. They're totally in shock. And Captain Ross, he just struggles for a logical explanation for this. He says, there's got to be an explanation. You know, this isn't happening. So he finally...
He can't be a Vulcan. I don't see no ears.
That's
Point
right.
Of ears.
That's right. I mean, this is not Star Trek here, you know? So he finally decides that, you know, somehow they've changed time. They've bent it in some way, in such a way as to get a glimpse of the future. All they have to do is just avoid their fate, and or all they have to do to avoid their fate is to stay on the ground, not go back in space, and thereby they'll avoid the accident. They'll avoid the crash. So, you know, Mason, he's a little skeptical, and Carter, he's totally disoriented, but they agree with him. So soon Carter finds himself, Lieutenant Carter, he finds himself transported back to a pleasant little town on Earth, a little country lane, and he encounters figures from his past who are dead. He runs into the house that he and his wife once shared, and he finds that it's empty except for a telegram notifying Mary Carter that her husband has died in the line of duty. So Carter, he's freaked out from this. Ross, Captain Ross, he comes down. Somehow he comes into this nightmare of his. It's not even a nightmare. I would say a dream of his. And he gets him out of it. And he says that he's suffering from a delusion. And that delusion, Lieutenant Mason shares as well. Because he just had an emotional reunion with his dead wife and child. And so Captain Ross pulls him back to reality. Mason freaks out. And he actually, you know, he hits the captain in a, like, furious rage. And Captain Ross now has this new theory of what's going on. He believes the planet's inhabited by telepathic aliens who are using humans' fear of death to keep them away from their world.
Where
and
people
Ross,
can dream of green Orion skin girls, right?
Yeah, there you okay. go. There you go. That's exactly right. So Ross yeah. says if they take the E-89 back into space, well, that should break the spell. So they take it back in the orbit without a hitch. Mason and Carter, they sort of agree that Ross might be right about the aliens, even though they're a little resentful and begrudging of this, but they're stunned when Ross says that they're going to land the craft again to gather foreign samples to bring back to Earth. So after all, you know, he figures now they know what's going on. They don't have anything to fear. So they land again. They discover that the wreck of the craft is still there, and they're confused and they're scared. And Mason and Carter, they come to the one and only conclusion left. They've crashed, and they are indeed dead. Still, Ross won't accept the truth. His stubborn personality is holding the crew back, and he exclaims they're going to go over it again and again and again until he figures it out. And suddenly the episode, it just cuts back to Mason's discovery of the metallic object on the planet, with Ross saying, I don't see anything. So they're just going back over and over, and they're going to live this throughout eternity. So this episode brings up a lot of questions about life and death. I mean, can someone really put off their own death? Can someone continue the happy life that they had on Earth after death? Do we really join our loved ones in the afterlife? I mean, you know, these astronauts in this episode had to deal with all these issues, among others. And interestingly enough, this episode was very much like Judgment Night from season one. Now, the captain on this mission, Captain Ross, he discovers, along with the other two crewmen, that they've crashed and died. But he refuses to accept this outcome. And he keeps insisting there's a logical explanation. But there's not. There's not a logical explanation. Because of his stubborn determination to find another explanation, the three of them are forced into a nightmare, which means they're going to live and relive and relive and relive the scenario over and over and over again for all eternity. So it's very much like the outcome of Judgment Night. But at this point in the series, I think that we've all become used to seeing plot lines being repeated. And I don't mind that so much if the story's a good one. Now, this story is just okay. It would have been pretty good if it was a 30-minute episode, but that's the case with most of the season four episodes. I thought the best part of the episode was Jack Klugman. I mean, the man is always phenomenal. I mean, this performance was no exception. It's just a shame that it wasn't a better story for him. But, you know, somehow he always rises to the occasion. I mean, he was good in this. And we've had the pleasure of seeing him in four Zone episodes. His fourth and last appearance will be in season five's In Praise of Pip. But in Death Ship, Klugman as Captain Ross, he's tough. He's a no-nonsense guy. And his two crew members, they really don't like him. But they do as he says because they have to. You know, they don't want to cross him. And Ross Martin, he plays Lieutenant Mason. And he, you know, I mean, it's obvious that he is resentful of Ross. I mean, he's totally resentful. But, you know, We saw Ross Martin in season one's The Four of Us Are Dying, and that wasn't a very memorable role for him. But as Lieutenant Mason here, he renders a very impressive and emotional performance. I mean, when you see him crying, you know, when he sees his daughter and he's hugging her and he starts crying, I mean, you know, a very, very emotional episode, or not episode, but scene, very emotional scene for him, you know, just seeing him grabbing her and crying and realizing that, you know, he missed them so much. And Lieutenant Carter, he was played by Frank Bear, and he was decent enough in this. He played the distraught astronaut. You know, he just wanted to die in peace and not float around in space forever. Well, who would want to do that? But you know, he actually appeared with Klugman a few years later in an episode of The Odd Couple. I've never seen that episode, but I have to look for it. One scene, though, I have to say in this episode, one scene that was particularly jolting was when Mason was standing outside of the crash ship, and as he pictures the disaster, the crash in his mind, we hear the loud roar of the engines as the ship descends and crashes. And you sit there and you're thinking, well, was that just in his mind, or is that how it really went down? I mean, is that what really happened? So, I mean, I can certainly understand someone trying to avoid death. Nobody wants to die. Captain Ross, he was just so rock solid, sure that he and those guys, the lieutenants, he was so sure that they weren't dead that he was willing to spend eternity floating aimlessly through space. The other guys wanted to meet their fate. They believed it. You know, they believed they were dead. They knew they were dead. So it was a fairly predictable ending. It took a long time to get to it, but, you know, and of course the good old spaceship from Forbidden Planet makes yet another one of its many Zone appearances. Boy, talk about getting your money's worth out of a prop, right? I mean, that spaceship has been in so many episodes.
And yeah, I was thinking the day the Earth stood still, but it could have been the same ship for
yes,
both of those.
Yes, exactly. I mean, God, I can't believe how many times that thing's shown up. And, you know, one other thing I will say was well done in this episode, the split screen scenes. They did that really well. I thought the split screen scenes were done fairly well. Now, someone did say that they saw the seam when Ross Martin was talking to his dead self there. They said, I didn't see it. I mean, maybe I wasn't looking close enough. I've seen this episode many times. I didn't really see the seam, but someone did said that they saw it. I don't know. But I thought it was well done.
Yeah, they could have cleaned it up with the DVD release. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it was more prevalent when you are watching like high definition or something, I guess. But you know, good acting. You know, the acting was good. You know, good acting did help the episode. It needed a little more though. It needed something else, a better story, something that didn't Yeah. Something that didn't move along so tediously. I thought it was very slow and tedious, but I'm still going to rate it a 2 for average. It wasn't terrible. And Sunday,
so do you feel this was at the beginning of the adventure, or you think they were still in progress of the loop itself?
What do you mean?
Do you think that we came in at the start of it, or did we come into the story where it's already have repeated?
I think it's already, I think we've come in when it's already, they've already gone through this numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
We're caught in a time loop.
Chronic hysteresis, that's what we're in.
Oh, God. Now, Sonny said that, like, the film 1984, 1997 seems so far in the future. And when this episode came out, who would have dreamed they'd be on a home PC on the internet in 1997? Yeah. And so realistic, too, she said. Yeah, you're right, Sonny. I agree. I agree with that. And what are you saying, Dave? Fifth Doctor, Doctor Who? Yeah. Yeah, Judge.
Are you sure it wasn't the Fourth Doctor, Meglis, Dave?
No, it's the, from like Castrovalvin or something.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, might be, yeah. Of course, yeah.
It's Bo, you're right.
I should know it off the top of my head, yeah.
I know you were joking, Sonny. I know, because that thing looked, to me, the flying saucer from Forbidden Planet always looks like something out of, like, that you would get in a toy box or a Cracker Jack box. It looks like a child's toy. You know, and when they did that, I forget, Robert, was it first or second season? Third from the Sun, I think that was first season.
Oh, you're talking about for
the one with Fritz Weaver, Third from the Sun.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, that was used in there, and that's when I first said it looked just like a child's toy, you know, seeing that flying saucer. Yeah, the prop was very cheap looking, but for that time, I guess it was.
I never thought that, and I have people that sit and watch it, and their jaws drop, and their special effects people today who say, how the hell did they make that look so good?
Wait a minute, Rick. You don't think that Forbidden Planet is
flying? I repeat, special effects people from today who sit there with their jaws dropped and say, how did they make it look so good?
Oh, that prop looked cheap.
I agree. I think, I mean, you kind of know that it's an, I mean, you know that it's from its era. From its era, it's actually a really nice looking film.
Looks like a cheap toy.
I was even impressed with the little dust cloud that the ship made when it landed on the planet.
Oh, yeah, that was okay. Yeah, that was all right. But the prop, the...
Three of the people who have said that to me are Academy and Emmy Award winners. How many have you won?
They were drunk, Rick. Come on.
No, they weren't.
It's a cheap-looking prop. Come on. I think
says somebody not in the business.
Oh, I think Daphne would even think it was cheap. And I trust, and I respect Daphne's opinion.
Woof. Well, you know, watching that stuff when we're kids, we never think about that. It always seems that when we become adults, where we start picking things apart in movies.
Right,
and
you're a kid, all those
like
props
that
look exciting to you. You know, all those props look great. But then we are talking about the 60s, you know, and props were not, as far as I'm concerned, props were not really, had not really come that far at that point.
Some people were ahead of their time. Ray Harryhausen down the road was before his time as well, with a lot of movies he did and special effects.
Well, okay. All right, well, Robert, I'm going to turn.
Well, I just killed the whole conversation here, didn't I?
Okay. No, I think I did, but that's besides the point.
Close enough, okay.
My own way, too.
I was about ready to put the crickets on, but I guess I don't have to. Okay.
All right. It's over to you, babe. Go ahead.
Dev Ship, I thought while watching this, I mean, it wasn't hard to tell who was the alpha male in the story. It was Captain Ross. And you could always tell the leaders from the followers. And You know, your followers were Mason, Carter, and more Mason, I think. Carter
did
really wanted
ranks,
to stand
you know?
Up. Yeah, Lieutenant.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I think Mason was the weaker of the three. I think Carter really wanted to stand up to him, but he was kind of backed down. And
Who? Carter?
No,
The real, no. The meek one, the one who's real meek?
Mason.
Yeah,
I thought
Mason
Carter.
The one that Ross Martin played.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Carter really wanted to stand up to him, but he kind of backed down from that.
Yeah.
But what really got to me is we could tell that they got trapped in some kind of, what I called it, purgatory. And the purgatory was pretty much caused by the captain not accepting that they were dead, pretty much. And sometimes the fear of death causes us to hold on to life, as it did with the captain. When you have such a dominating spirit, it's, you know, hard to let go of your surroundings. It really agitated me the way he was controlling his lieutenants. He tries to look at the situation in a logical way. That's why I was teasing you, Lynn, about the Vulcan ears and situation with that. First of all, you can't look at it in a logical way because you're dead. Just face it.
Exactly.
And go on to the afterlife. And also the second part, stop dragging your crewmates into your hell. Let them go. That is all
I could think about
while watching this.
They were happy.
They were.
You know, Ross Martin, he met his wife and daughter, and he wanted to be with them. Why leave them alone? Why won't you let them just be with them?
I mean, they were in the afterlife. I mean, they didn't have to go through Captain Ross's hell. But unfortunately, he was the dominating spirit, which we can call him spirit. Now they got to be trapped in their ghostly existence, becoming, as Rod says at the end, the Flying Dutchman of space. And I kind of wish that he would have left it open-ended at the end. I mean, he pretty much put the stamp on it that, yes, these people are dead at the closing monologue that he gives, and that they're the Flying Dutchman. I mean, if he would have left the ending open, it could have raised some possibilities like a parallel world where they weren't in their own existence or world, but they were in a parallel world, and that the ones that were dead in the spaceship could have been their parallel doppelganger, so to say. That could have been a possibility. But as I said, you know, Rod kind of put the stamp on the end of it that, you know, yes, they are dead. So, you know, and we have to go with that. But just like the Big Tall Wish with the boxer in that one, we get the emo captain not accepting their fate and trying to find ways to disapprove that they are dead. Come on, get over it and move on. I mean, I like Jack Klugman as an actor, and he played the role of the domineering captain excellently. And I feel that Ross Martin, you know, Wild Wild West, played the role of Lieutenant Mason okay, but was somehow wasted in a somewhat overly linked story. Again, this should have been, as I agree with Lynn, a 25-minute story, not a 50-minute one. All in all, I was debating if I was going to change my rating. I was thinking about moving it up to a T, two. I have a 1.5. I might just keep it there, but I was thinking about moving it up to a 2 because reason why I was thinking that is because it brings up a lot of future stories, movies, TV series where this idea being caught in a time loop or chronic hysteresis or whatever we want to call temporal instability, want to call, you know, this situation. And of course, examples I have, and if I miss any, Dave, you can remind me of anything I may miss. Of course, we all know the classic Groundhog's Day one.
Oh, yeah.
And basically, we are spared in this episode from having it repeated two or three times. In the movie, though, certain scenes got repeated over and over again. It basically, Bill Murray's redemption, his character trying to be a better person and, you know, whatever, whoever you want to call God or whatever, trying to have him make his life a little bit better. And, you know, along each of the loop, having to change things to improve himself. There's a scene from the movie where he goes into a bar, and Andy McDowell's character is in there, and he orders a drink. It's a scene from that.
So, what are the chances of getting out today?
Van still won't start. Larry's working on it.
Wouldn't you know it? Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Jim Beam, ice, water.
For you, miss?
Sweet vermouth in the rocks with a twist, please.
What are the chances of getting out of town today?
The van still won't start. Larry's working on it.
Oh, wouldn't you know it? Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Sweet vermouth, rocks with a twist, please.
For you, miss?
The same. That's my favorite drink.
Mine, too. It always makes me think of Rome. The way the sun hits the buildings in the afternoon.
Well, what should we drink to?
To the groundhog.
I always drink to world peace.
Can I buy you a drink?
Okay.
Sweet vermouth, rocks with a twist, please.
For you, miss?
The same. That's my favorite drink.
Mine, too. It always makes me think of Rome. The way the sun hits the buildings in the afternoon.
Well, what should we drink to?
I like to say a prayer and drink to world peace.
World peace.
World peace.
You hear him say at the end, whatever. I love that second one where there's that long pause and she says world peace and he just looks at her. World peace.
That was a good movie. I really like that movie.
And it seems like he goes over and over these things and you would think it'd be tedious and boring. But actually, the movie with the comic humor is quite funny. It's one of
Bobby watches that every time it's on. He watches every time he comes across it. He watches it.
And I don't think it ever says. And they interviewed the directors and producers, Hal Ramis and all of them, asked them, was there a certain time period that this took place? And I don't know if they ever really gave an answer. Did Dave ever say how long they were stuck, or Murray's character was stuck in this loop?
Well, he's died hundreds of times, doesn't he? He literally, he could have been stuck in it for, you know, a few years. I mean, he learns to play the piano on his first lesson,
yeah.
For say. He learns to play classical and jazz and improvise.
He also learns how to do ice sculptures.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was in there for quite a while.
It's supposed to be that one day, but who knows?
Well, we know it's the one day.
Yeah, it was.
He's in it a long time.
Repeated. Yeah, I mean, he probably didn't keep count. I mean, my favorite scene from the movie is the scene where
he
falls out of a tree.
Yeah, I mean,
never get a thank you.
Yeah. I mean, some of the days were quite short because he only lived an hour because he kept trying to kill himself.
Yeah.
So some days didn't. A lot of the days didn't last the whole 24 hours, if you know what I mean.
Supposedly one 24-hour period. That's what I meant.
Yeah. I mean, for him it did, because there is a scene where we see his dead body, like at the coroner's.
Right.
So presumably time went, and then eventually it resets for him, where he's aware of it being reset in the morning.
Yeah, it's a groundhog.
Right.
Don't drive angry. Don't drive angry.
But they specifically said, you know.
Yeah. I know they talked to him, but I think they left that open for people.
Yeah.
Interpretation, what they thought. Yeah, it would have been wild if it was a couple years or whatever you said today, about 3 or 4. Whatever.
Yeah, the part that I never understood in that movie, and it's probably a mistake, the teacher goes, he's my student. But he was only her student for a day, but she's so proud of him when he performs. It's like, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be aware that you've been teaching him all this time.
Yeah. Yeah,
but
yeah.
She goes like, he's my student. She's like so proud of him. Like, you only taught him for a day, from your point of view. So I don't know how you can be so proud. it's actually a very good movie. It's very clever.
Yeah.
Then what I wanted to bring up too is, of course, Star Trek: The Next Generation, and in my review I mentioned that as cause and effect. Very much. It's an episode I enjoy, like yesterday's Enterprise and some of the other ones where we have time involved. But in this one, we have the time loop for the Enterprise, where it always starts at the beginning with Beverly Crusher going through her evening, and then it's culminating into this scene at the end. And then it repeats over.
Report.
Sensors didn't detect the phenomenon until we were almost on top of it, sir.
It is a highly localized distortion of the space-time continuum. On screen.
Back us off, Ensign. Nice and slow.
Aye, sir. Captain, maneuvering thrusters are not responding.
The distortion field is fluctuating.
All main systems just went down. Power levels are dropping rapidly.
Red alert! There's an energy buildup in the distortion field.
We have to get out of here now.
Captain, something is emerging.
Shields up. Evade the maneuver. Shields inoperative.
The helm's not responding.
The vessel is on a collision course. Impact in 36 seconds.
Hail him.
No response. Suggestions?
Decompress main shuttle bay. The explosive reaction may kick us out of the way.
Captain, I suggest we use the tractor beam to alter the other ship's trajectory.
Mr. Wolf, make it so.
Engaging tractor beam. Damage report!
Casualty reports coming in from all over the ship!
Starboard nacelle sustained a direct impact, preventing drive plasma.
Initiating emergency core shutdown.
Inertial dampers failing. We're losing attitude control.
This is the bridge. All hands to emergency escape pod. The core shutdown was unsuccessful. We are losing antimatter containment.
We've got to eject the engine core.
Ejection systems are offline. The core breach is imminent.
All hands abandon ship. Repeat, all hands abandon.
And then the Enterprise explodes, and we go back to the captain giving his log. This goes over. But they, as they restart and go through it, they have some kind of an inkling or a shadow of something. And then we find out the whole episode is basically about a decision that is made that is causing them to stay in this loop. And the ship that they hit is called the Bozeman. My question I wanted to ask you guys is, was the Bozeman the one that was involved in Worf battle with the Borg? Was that one of the ships that they used when they were battling?
Do say it, and a lot of people also say there's a small voiceover and that it does sound like Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah.
They do say that.
Yeah.
Bozeman
take a 70-year-old ship and put him in there, huh?
All the ships they have to fight.
It could have been a new Bozeman, too, because there were like 30 Enterprise.
They couldn't afford Kelsey Grammer's asking for a cameo.
He was doing Frasier later on. Or was he doing Frasier during that time?
Yes, he was.
It was in the 80s, late 80s. Late 80s, early 90s,
Well, he was playing either Frasier on Cheers or Frasier on Frasier, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that's one I always remember. Cause and Effect is one of my favorite episodes I like. We pass it on to everybody else here. 1.5 out of 5.
1.5, okay, Dave?
Well, it started out so well. Good heavens, we've got spaceships, science fiction program. I mean, what's not to like? So, I rewatched it today, and it's a long time since I watched it, so... I was really hopeful for this, but this didn't stand the 1 hour mark test. But as a concept, The first half of it, I really loved. I'll put a link in the room, by the way. This is from the TARDIS wiki that mentions some of the notable times with the time loop in Doctor Who. And it was the fourth Doctor, Meglos. That was one where the Doctor and Romana were caught at the time loop. He kept knocking over the hat stand and things.
I knew a man assaulted insoluble by the strangest means. He sees the threads that join the universe together and mends them when they break.
Hello there, I'm Doctor, I'm expecting...
Arrival noted, gentlemen. Welcome.
What are you?
I am Meglos.
I think what we've got here is a good old-fashioned doppelganger.
What they're asking us to do is impossible.
I think you forget who I am.
Where's the Doctor?
He's betrayed us.
Arrest the Time Lord. Stop him at all costs.
The problem with doppelgangers, you never know who's who.
Did you see it, Thomas?
I hope it was all worth it, Meglos.
Stop, goddamn patience! We are about to release a power many magnitudes greater than any intelligence has ever controlled. Its potential has scarcely been touched.
But there was also... the one in Sarah Jane Adventures. There was also another one in Torchwood, where Captain Jack and Captain the one played by Spike,
John,
John Hart. That was the episode Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Captain Jonathan Hart.
Yeah, and of course there was another famous one in the Doctor Who where River Song was stuck in a time loop with the exploding TARDIS. That's the one that Ian the Sixth Doctor likes a lot, because every time she rushes to those get out, we see a lovely view of her departing rear end, as it were. But
I think it was the
quite
Big
like
Bang,
that.
And
yeah,
what was
that's
the
what
other
Ian
part?
Got. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So lots of things, but no, I know Lynn says Jack Klugman. I think you said always rises to the occasion. Immediately in my head popped up the word, he always rages against the situation. I mean, he acted exactly the same as he did in 12 Angry Men, you know, where he... and, of course, we saw... He was in the trumpet episode of... the
Passage
one with,
of Trumpet, yeah, Passage of Trumpet.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me. Oh, and he was in the pool player one.
Gabriel,
where,
my favorite.
Yeah,
he's one of small game of pool.
Yeah, I think he's one of these. You know, they say, you know, which is best to in life, to have talent and have luck, and a lot of very modest actors say, well, I had a little bit of talent, but it was mostly luck. And I think also you can say about actors, especially TV actors, there are actors that can act. And there are actors that people like watching acting, you know what I mean, if you know what I mean. And I can forgive Jack Goodman this. I mean, I loved him in his role where he was the detective.
Quincy.
Every week he was on a crusade about something. You know, he'd meet a blind woman and he'd be on a crusade about why blind women aren't looked after. And then next week he'd meet one about somebody abusing animals and on that. And then, you know, so I mean, it was a crusade every week. That was what was so endearing about him. I mean, whether the poor guy got typecast, I don't know, but. To get back to it, I mean, up to the halfway point, I was along for the ride and really enjoyed it, because I was thinking, because one of the things that can sometimes upset you, and did eventually with this one, is, you know, everybody knows, even though we haven't been to all these planets, everybody knows that if you're going to pick a crew of a ship that are going to fly together in the same spaceship for years and years, you know, they've got to be, you know, tested for compatibility and tested that they don't lose their temper and level-headedness and calm under stress.
Right.
And every time you see that, you always have... So, I mean, they used to do it, and for those people in the room, much older than Lynn, because she wouldn't remember, but they always do it in war films where they're in submarines, which, of course, submarines and war films make a great analogy for space ones, because of course they're just stuck under the water, but they're still in this encapsulated world where they're on top of each other, and if it springs a leak to water, that's just as fatal as leaking air into space. But you always have this person who go, you know, what they call stir crazy, as it were, in it. And
people cannot predict what they do. There will be people who will jump into command who you never thought would, and there are people who will cower and whatnot when you thought that they wouldn't.
Well, I realized that, but they seemed, I mean, of course, and I think this goes into this time loop situation, because for us it seems as though, you know, one of them cracks very quickly, but anyway, going back to the point, the captain, I was thinking, you know, the captain's got a point. They're not our buddies. Well, look, we're alive. It might be a possible fate for us, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen. And I liked all his reasoning. And I was with him when he said, well, let's not take off. I mean, we don't know what the development of space is. Now, if they'd have put a line in, like, you know, like with a Star Trek Enterprise, that's the only ship that's capable of, you know, travelling to far distant worlds. Although in actual fact, in the preliminary narration, I think they do say that their task was to go and seek out another world to look for, you know, vegetation and plant life and food sources. So
because the Earth was overpopulated,
So you have to assume that Earth sent out quite a few of these ships, especially when this one has a designated letter behind it. Oh, and jumping around a little bit, I was thinking, they're very upbeat about how far man gets. I mean, remember, it says 1997 at the beginning. And then I'm thinking, hang on a minute, this was made in 1963. That was 34 years in the future. Now, anybody in this room, I don't know about you guys, but if some person came to me and say, you know, what do you think life will be like in 34 years? Well, I've got to say, I think we'd have a colony on the moon and may just have established one on Mars. Now,
I'm still waiting for Jupiter 9, Dave. Where is it gone?
Anyway, the whole in fact, I'm stretching my hands out to twice its length. Up to the halfway point, I was completely on board about this, and then they seemed to use the paranoia, as it were, just to carry it out. I mean, when they first go searching the spaceship on the first one, I mean, you can hear the director shouting to them, move more. Slowly. You're moving. Slow down. I mean, it took about 3 minutes to cross a 10-foot gap, you know. But having said that, I have a fondness for this sort of story, and I think it started well. I like the way the captain was arguing it out. I mean, one of the things the captain says is he said, it's mind control, because one of you was thinking about alien life, and therefore we see our act by alien life. But the captain's just as well. He's so sure about his interpretation. So I'm going to cut my overlong-winded answer here and say I liked it, but I liked it because I liked that sort of thing. It really did. It overblew itself, and it definitely should have been a half-hour episode. So I can only really give it 2.5. Although I like that sort of a story, but it wasn't enough meat in it, and that's me, I think.
So what is your rating then?
2.5. I mean, I'd like to give it a solid 3.5, but I just can't justify that because, it's a one-page script, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's a half-hour show. Yeah, it could have been a half-hour.
Have you ever done that where you hit the print button and it doesn't print, so you hit it 3 times, and then your bloody printer spews out 4 copies of the same page?
Yeah.
It's a little bit of that.
So, Dave, you said the story wasn't a steak then. It was more of a watercress sandwich for you.
But the thing is, I do like that sort of story. I, I can't help but like it, so I am giving it Bobby will think a ridiculous score, but I'm certainly giving it a generous score of 2.5. But Bobby, I know I'm doing that, but it's something I like about those sort of stories.
All right. And Rick is starving, he says, so he needs to go next so he can go eat. All right, Rick, go ahead.
All right, let's see. There's a scene in something called Harrow House where in the episode called The Coming of Christina, where Christina is sitting with the caretaker, and the caretaker says, "Christina, you're dead." And she proceeds to deny it. He goes, "Really? Feel your pulse. Have you eaten anything? Okay, I really don't think it was a time loop. I think they're just in denial. They're ghosts in denial, trying to figure out what the heck is going on, that they aren't dead."
So you think, Rick, it's like the others?
Sort of, kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
To me, there really was no indication of a time loop per se. They never really did rectify the problem. The ship was always there, and the ship was always crashed.
But that isn't that the definition of a time loop? When this story starts, we get to the end and it gets back to the start again. Isn't that a definition of a time loop?
Not really.
But is there a time when you're dead? Or is there a time at all when you're dead?
Right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Who was it who, when Martin said, "It's obvious we're dead"? I think that was one of Ross Martin's lines.
Yeah.
Or one of the other actors' lines. No, I think it was Ross Martin.
It was Ross Martin who said that.
Lieutenant Mason. Yeah.
At least that's what I get from it. Knowing Matheson, it is a ghost story, not a time travel story.
No, I didn't think of it as a time travel story either.
I didn't think of it as time travel, because they never travel through time. They keep repeating it.
Yeah,
right.
To me, it was more like, as I said, it reminded me of Judgment Day, and also that episode with Dennis Weaver, Shadow Play. He's reliving things over and over. It's going to relive his death over and over and over and over again. So, this has been done a few times.
Shadow Play, that's great. Anyway. I love that episode, though.
Yeah, that's the one.
But I want steak instead of lamb. Why?
Yeah. The steaks and the steaks.
I can't wake up. Don't you understand? You'll all die. just because of the acting, I'll give it a 3.
Okay. Yeah, I thought the acting was very good.
Yeah.
Well, I thought Jack Klugman is just as popular as Burgess Meredith was in the series as well.
Yeah, and they basically, Burgess Meredith was in 5 episodes, Jack Klugman was in, what was he, in 4, right? 4 episodes?
Yeah.
And
let's
Burgess
see,
was in 5. Yeah.
Yeah, about 4 or 5, I think, too, yeah.
Yeah, 4 for Jack and 5 for Burgess. Burgess had the most, yeah.
Oh, he does?
Yeah, he was in 5 episodes.
Oh.
Yeah, he finishes up this season, and then Klugman's got one more in season 5. So.
Yes, so it's 5 and 4. And I think, what's his name, William Shatner had
2.
3. Like no,
that.
He had
was
the
it 3?
Time. Yeah, he had Nick of Time. He had
right.
Nightmare 20,000 Feet. And there was another one. Which one?
But he only had 2.
Was it 2 only?
Mm.
That's what. Only had 3. No, maybe it was 2. Yeah, you're right. Nick of Time and Nightmare 20,000 Feet.
Right. Yeah.
It was another one. Mm. Okay, so it was basically Burgess Meredith and Jack Klugman had the most episodes, yeah. All right, so you give it a 3. And Lou.
Okay, I kind of enjoyed the episode. I'm a little bit like Dave. I'm partial to these science fiction stories. What I liked about it was how it just kept shifting direction in terms of plot, or at least in terms of plot ideas. Because when I first started watching it, I thought, oh, well, this is going to be a time travel story. They somehow went back in time, and now they're going to try to prevent their own deaths. And then you had the scenes where the characters go back and they see their loved ones. So I'm thinking, like, oh, they're going in a lost direction. They're in purgatory now, so now they just have to figure out that they're dead. And then Jack Klugman comes up with the whole idea that it's illusions, and I immediately thought of a Star Trek episode called The Menagerie.
Yeah, there's got to be an explanation, some sort of explanation, yeah.
Yeah, that there were illusions, and that, you know, so I saw they're going in this direction where there are, you know, aliens that are doing this thing, and they'll confront them when they land back on the planet. And then, of course, you know, when they take off, and then, you know, then Jack Klugman says they want to return, you know, all of a sudden they're struggling over the controls, and the ship's about to crash, and you're like, oh, look, they're doing what is going to happen. But then, of course, they pull the ship to safety. So then it's not that story. It's not that they, you know, were going to automatically cause their own deaths. It was just, you know, preordained. They land on the planet, and then, of course, you know, they're like, they're all happy that they don't see their ship in the distance. But, of course, they go to each window, and they play this really nice music to make it seem like. But then, of course, they open up the last window, and there's the ship. So it's like, oh, no, what happened? So then we're back to the purgatory story again. And so, you know, all those little constant shifts in plot ideas and stories, you know, I kind of like that it kept me kind of guessing in what direction this episode was going to go. So, you know, I actually enjoyed it. You know, there were a couple of things that bothered me. I mean, there was a moment, you know, when Jack Klugman says that it's aliens and stuff like that, and he's being all logical and everything, but part of me was thinking, like, yeah, but why would they be flashing light from, like, space so that you would have to investigate in the first place?
Right.
So that didn't really go into, like, his logical thinking. And also, you know, cueing from the Menagerie episode, you know, if they can make them see anything, you know, who's to say when they take off they don't make them press the wrong button, blow up the ship, whatever. So, you know, I don't know if he thought it out all the way. But, like I said, I liked all the shifts in direction that the episode took. And it was an average story, but the fact that it just kept me guessing in what direction it was going, you know, kind of intrigued me and kept me hooked for the most part. So, you know, I mean, and like you said, Jack Klugman's performance and all their performances were pretty good, especially the scenes where they, you know, they confront their, you know, I mean, when What's-His-Name realizes that the two people he met at the beginning were actually dead, the old lady and the guy who was hunting. And then the scene where Mason meets with his family and just that emotional reaction that he has at seeing his daughter and seeing his wife.
Although the way he cried was, I mean, that was very good acting on his part, yeah.
Admittedly, you have to wonder, though, I mean, was that real, was that not? Because, I mean, it always seems to happen that whenever you meet a dead person, they don't know why, you know, why you're wondering, why are you so upset? Why? What's wrong? Why are you crying? You know, like, they have no idea. You're in heaven, don't you realize that?
Yeah, well, you saw that. That's what his daughter said. She was like, Daddy, why are you crying?
Exactly.
She's like, because I'm so happy to see you.
Yeah.
Well, that's
and they never, like, just say it. They never blurt it out. You know, you died, and now I haven't seen you again. I must be in heaven. They never explain it back to her.
Yeah, kids not going to understand that.
Yeah. But, you know.
Wait a minute. Aren't you Uncle Ralph from 30 years ago? You're supposed to be dead.
But the one thing that also bothered me was the idea that Jack Klugman's personality and his will could be strong enough to trap two souls with him in, like, purgatory. It's like these people are just under his thumb, even on a spiritual level. You know?
Like his force of will, isn't it, almost?
Yeah,
as well.
Exactly. But it seems like, wow, you know, that I thought was interesting. That's why, you know, I remember you mentioned that you wish they left it a little open-ended.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of leaning towards that way, too, but I was thinking, if we left it open-ended, we're going to be like the Jack Klugman character. Well, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. There must be some logical answer to this plot, to this story. So I'm kind of glad that...
Well, said there's no time, so they have all of eternity to do it over and over again.
Yeah,
I
kind of like the ending because it kind of, like, you know, lets us... I mean, it's kind of a sad story. I mean, it is a sad story, but, I mean, the idea that one person's will can be strong enough to dominate two people, and on a spiritual level, it's not just that they're people, it's their souls. He's trapping their souls. They get these glimpses of heaven or whatever, but he keeps them there. And not only does he keep them there, he causes this time loop that you guys like to say. He causes them to repeat it again.
The one possibility is that he's the only one there, and there is they're figments of his imagination as well.
That's a possibility. Yeah, he has to keep the idea that he's alive going. So maybe it is just him.
Because when he comes in and the scene with Ross Martin, when he comes in, he, like, literally grabs him by the throat. I mean, he's dragging him back by his throat, you know, and it's like a brutal scene. It's like, oh, my God, you know, he's, like, forcing him back with all his might. And so, I mean, I thought that was an incredible scene.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Lou,
yeah, I mean,
you know, describes the preacher from the Poltergeist movies. Remember
yeah.
how he was?
From the second one, yeah.
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 Yep.
I mean, I remember there's that scene where Jack Klugman comes out of the, like, the, not the, like, the tall grass. And it reminded me of Field of Dreams. I'm like, oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Field of Dreams one. You know, if you
yes.
if you call him, he will come.
And for Kevin Costner to walk out.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, all those switches and ideas of where the plot was going to go actually kept me hooked, kept me more interested. I was going to give it 2.5, but because of those constant plot twists, or not plot twists, but directions and where the story was going, I'm going to give it 3 stars.
Okay, that's cool. All right. So we've got all our ratings here. Now we have a new person here, Oscar. Oscar, just checking in one more time. Do you want to say anything, or are you just listening? Because I know you said you're just listening. If you wanted to say anything, here's your chance. But he
right.
said he was muted at his end.
Well, I got my microphone faded down at my end so that I don't make any noises that would disrupt what you're doing. But
sounds like coming in good there.
Easy to shove the fader up and speak. But are you a bunch of Twilight Zone anoraks then, are you?
Yes.
I'm more of a dabbler. But I enjoyed this show when I was in my youth, and I've always watched it whenever it would come on.
I'm a Twilight Zone freak. Yes, yes, Twilight Zone.
Believe me, I know that. Definitely.
I adore the Twilight Zone.
Anyone that has this picture hanging up on a wall.
Yes, Rod Sterling autographed picture, yes.
Yep.
Okay. All right, well, I'll leave you to it. I was just sort of having a nosy and listening in, and
oh, that's how I got involved with this group. I just saw
good to hear
another
English voice in the room as well.
Yeah, I noticed there was one other in the
Where are you from,
yet.
Oscar? Where are you from?
Yeah, I'm in London, outskirts of London, Royal Borough of Kingston upon Thames, which is sort of southwest London.
Then are you, Dave?
Me, I'm in Manchester. I'm in Manchester, as I guess you can tell.
Okay. Yeah. Sound more north. Well, I was born and raised in Yorkshire, actually, but I've been away from there for a very long time. So the accent has got a bit more southern, I think, over the years.
Right. Well, if you're interested in science fiction, look out for the Cult Detective podcast on TalkShoe. Call ID 54821. Sorry,
okay.
Lee.
54821, yeah.
That hosted by you, is it?
Myself and Ian, the Sixth Doctor.
Right. Okay, well, I'm always kind of having a look around to see what's about and, you know, dip in and out of stuff that looks interesting.
Oh, we'd love to have you come in here whenever you'd like. We do the show every 2 weeks,
okay.
And we do the episodes in chronological order. So the next one we're going to be doing will be on September. Yes, Bell. That'll be in 2 weeks on September 14th. We would love to have you join us.
Okie doke.
And we do it the same time, 6 p.m. Eastern time. Dave, what time is it there? What time is it for you guys?
We're 5 hours ahead.
We do
the collective on Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern. All the times on TalkShoe you'll find are Eastern United States time. But that's 7 p.m.
Right.
on Sundays.
Well, congratulations. A new day for you guys. Isn't that after 12 midnight now?
No,
it's just on midnight, yeah.
I know you guys are hours ahead, but I always forget if it's 4 or 5. For some reason, I always forget if it's 4 or 5, so you're 5 hours ahead.
But you guys don't do daylight savings, do you?
We do, but not exactly on the same week.
Okay.
Yeah, I just always forget if it's 4 or 5, so it's 5 hours, so it's midnight there. All right, okay, but yeah, Oscar, we would love to have you here. So we're here every 2 weeks, so September 14th will be our next one, and we will be doing Jess Bell, starring Anne Francis.
Right.
So, yeah, I do hope to see you here again, and I hope to see everyone here again. And we've got our ratings for today's show, and it was a good show. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Had a really good time. And Rick left to eat. Yeah, he was hungry. So we will see everybody in 2 weeks for Jess Bell, and I hope everybody has a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And good night, Sonny. Good to see you here. I'm glad you came.
Thanks for coming, Sonny.
Yay. So I hope everyone has a wonderful rest of the weekend, and I will see you here in 2 weeks. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night.
Bye.
And we'll go out on Rod. Goodbye, everybody. Till next time.
Picture of a man who will not see anything he does not choose to see, including his own death. A man of such indomitable will that even the two men beneath his command are not allowed to see the truth, which truth is that they are no longer among the living, that the movements they make and the words they speak have all been made and spoken countless times before, and will be made and spoken countless times again, perhaps even unto eternity. Picture of a latter-day Flying Dutchman sailing into the Twilight Zone. Next, we delve into the realm of American folklore, and through the offices of a fine writer named Earl Hamner Jr., we peruse a little witchcraft and bring you a story called Jezebel. This exercise in terror and talisman stars Anne Francis and James Best.
Form a ring, circle right with a pretty little thing. Now break that ring with a corner swing. Go back home, do-sa-do.
I never seen no cat with spots like that. Witch.
I die and they lay me to rest, gonna go to the place that's the best. When I lay me down to die, gonna go up to the spirit in the sky. Going up to the spirit in the sky, that's where I'm gonna go when I die. When I die and they lay me to rest, gonna go to the place that's the best. Prepare yourself, you know it's a must.
Gotta have a friend in Jesus.
So you know that when you die, he's gonna recommend you to the spirit in the sky. Gonna recommend you to the spirit in the sky. That's where you're gonna go when you die. When you die and they lay you to rest, you're gonna go to the place that's the best. A sinner, never sin.
I got a friend in Jesus.
So you know that when I die, he's gonna set me up with the spirit in the sky. Oh, set me up with the spirit in the sky. That's where I'm gonna go when I die.
When I die
and they lay me to rest, I'm gonna go to the place that's the best. Go to the place that's the best. Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.